First step in managing patients with pain with opioid therapy is deciding whether or not that therapy is appropriate for that patient based on their condition. What strategies do physicians have available to them in helping them to make that decision?
The most recently published American Pain Society, American Academy of Pain Medicine guidelines, just published this year, really emphasize the importance of looking at this point that you've just brought up, which is to first establish what the diagnosis of the person is. Try to find out what is wrong with this person to the fullest extent possible. WNL on someone's medical report often means within normal limits. Too often it's meant to me, when I see that patient later, we never looked. And so people are not being adequately evaluated for what diagnosis is perpetuating their pain. In addition, you have to look at the whole person. What is the person's background from a psychosocial point of view? What is the person's medical history, medication history, substance use history? And decide if that person is an appropriate candidate or how that person can be managed effectively with different therapies. And so it's a process that looks very carefully at who the person is initially, not only medically, but non-medically.
And there's some very important questions that can, you know, one can cycle through very quickly with an individual. One is, what is conventional therapy for this problem? Has that approach been evaluated and treated? Number two is, are there safer and potentially more effective therapies that haven't been considered that are, there's some reasonable evidence that might be beneficial, again, within the circumstances of that unique patient? And number three, is this individual who can responsibly adhere to a plan of care, no matter what it is, but especially with the concerns that may exist about opioids?
Well, we've discussed that opioid therapy can be an effective component of pain management, but there is a reluctance by some physicians to initiate opioid therapy for many patients, due in part to the risk for opioid misuse, abuse, and diversion. Let's take a look at our second patient profile to introduce the concepts of opioid misuse and abuse. Jim is from Plainfield, Indiana, and was first prescribed medication for chronic back pain at age 17.
When I was 14, I picked up a guitar. And one day, I remember I was sitting in my bedroom in New York, and I said, I think I want to do this for a living.
I've been walking the razor's edge. I cut my feet again.
I worked with John Mellencamp, worked with REO Speedwagon.
Help me find my way.
I had a $7 million record deal, and I had life quite nice. Unfortunately for me at the time, my chronic pain had me by the throat, and my addiction was on its way. I've had 54 surgeries, most of them related to spina bifida. I don't remember much pain until I was in high school. The first time I took an opiate for pain, I didn't like it. It made me feel weird, but I do remember taking that same medication one day, and my headache went away. And so did my back pain. And so did my foot pain and all of the other pains that I had. I'm like, son of a gun, maybe this isn't so bad. Interestingly enough, the addiction part didn't really creep in until later. As far as the rock and roll lifestyle, I had no idea I had a problem. These are prescribed. Towards the end, I didn't take anything as directed. If it said take two every 4 hours, that meant take four every 2 hours. If it says don't add alcohol, that means add alcohol. Washing down five pills with a beer is not a good use of either substance. Because I have multi-problems as a result of the spina bifida, kidney, orthopedic, neurological, it made perfect sense that you would get a prescription for that pain when you saw that doctor. By the time I went and got help, I had 14 different doctors who I would go to back and forth to get prescriptions. Towards the very end, I would go through medicine cabinets. I was in treatment in Cleveland. I remember going and talking to the physician, and I said, whatever you say, I will do. End of story. They put me on a medication to wean me, and they slowly got me off of the medicine. We started going to 12-step meetings, and I've been full speed ahead with that ever since.
Treating addiction to chronic pain medicine is, in my opinion, like treating almost any other addiction. I think detoxification is essential, alignment in a program of treatment.
Okay, very good.
Here we have a patient with profound medical problems engaged in all types of activities to try to live with his chronic pain and address his addictions.
My recovery regimen is a lifestyle. It involves everything. It involves mind, body, and spirit. I still have pain, and now I deal with it in a whole different way. I deal with it as it comes, and I don't bury it. All right, let's rock and roll, kids. I've been running the Chronic Pain Rehabilitation Program at Methodist Hospital for 7 years.
Well, good morning.
Good morning.
What better thing can you do than take everything bad that ever happened to you and turn it into something good for somebody else?
Dr. Pasek.
So I lived in Indiana for a number of years, and I know Jimmy. I'm a big fan, in fact. And he's an incredibly talented guy, and I really admire the aspect of him that, you know, he's overcome so much adversity and turned so much negative into a positive, not only in his own life, but in the lives of so many other people. And so I really do admire him. As I watch that, though, one of the things I wouldn't want someone to get as a take-home message is the idea that if it happened to a guy like Jimmy, it could happen to me. Not every patient exposed to opioids is an addiction waiting to happen. The risk factors, the vulnerabilities have been well documented. They can be assessed. They can even be managed, and they're known. And so the issue really becomes, I don't know, I know Jimmy as a performer, and I know him a little bit, but I don't know his family history. I don't know his personal history prior to this video. And so those are the questions that I want to ask the patients referred to me when my physician colleagues are thinking about putting them on opioids. I ask them, what's their prior history? What's their family history? One of the things that strikes me about Jimmy's case is that because he was born with this problem, he got exposed to opioids as a very young man. That can sometimes be a risk factor for the development of an addiction. And so there are a lot of questions, but I really wouldn't want anybody looking at this or any other celebrity case as, wow, if it happened to somebody who really has their act together, it could easily happen to me.
In Deborah's profile, we saw the issue of poorly treated pain. In Jim's profile, we saw a little bit more of the issue of increased misuse and abuse of opioids. What can be done to strike a balance between the two?
Balance between perhaps the potential benefits and the potential harms, and harms being the misuse or abuse of a medication. First and foremost is properly selecting the patient, informing the patient of what is expected of that patient with respect to utilizing the medication, and really conceptualizing the medication use as a trial. It's a trial therapy. No treatment should be continued, for example, if there are features of ongoing use which would be harmful to the person. And that could even, in the use of opioids, being misusing them, not controlling your use. So, again, a trial approach with the understanding that the therapy can be continued, discontinued, or changed helps to, with proper monitoring and proper assessment, and the idea that thorough assessment helps to strike this balance, thorough monitoring helps to achieve this balance. All these have to be integrated.
Once you've made the decision that opioids are medically appropriate, you then have to make another decision about how you're going to do opioid therapy. And this becomes sometimes a little problematic for our colleagues in primary care. If their practice setup is such that they basically can only have to prescribe a month's worth at a time and see somebody for a very brief visit once a month, well, there's definitely a subset of the pain population that'll do very well in primary care pain management. But if somebody needs more than that because of their risk factors or their prior history, you have to be ready to make the referrals, et cetera, or structure therapy differently. And I don't think there's any problem if you can't, if you don't have the inclination, you don't have the staffing, you don't have the time to see a patient, say, once a week because they need it, because they can't handle a month's worth of medicine. There's no shame in referring those patients or bringing other consultants and people with other kinds of expertise in. You know, you've made a decision to give somebody access to a drug with potentially rewarding or qualities, which gives it an abuse liability. But exposure alone, as Perry was saying before, doesn't create addiction. Exposure in vulnerable people at vulnerable times creates addiction. And so if you recognize those vulnerabilities and you take that into account and you prepare to manage them, then you can do a lot of good, even for people who have a lot of risk factors. The prevalence of addiction is only one facet of it, though. There's an awful lot what's become to be known as aberrant drug-related behavior. And this is actually quite common. And it takes on this name aberrant, as if opioids are, you know, not taking opioids exactly as prescribed makes them unique. I think people don't take a lot of medicines exactly as prescribed. But when it's a controlled substance, it takes on a different kind of a meaning. And so we do see, my studies, in fact, indicate one out of every two patients in a chronic pain clinic have at least some behavior that should give their prescriber pause. It's not always addiction. Could be that their pain is poorly controlled. It could be that they've developed an anxiety disorder. It could be that somebody in their household has taken their medicines. It's a complex differential diagnosis. But we do see these behaviors, and they do challenge us, and they do make us have to stop and think, what does this mean so that I can respond?